Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized, and with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com, that's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Join Justin Townsend and the Harvesting Nature crew as they explore the world of cooking wild fish and game while sharing recipes, tips, tricks, and lessons learned from their pursuit of wild food. We sure hope you ate before the show, as you're going to leave hungry. This is the Wild Fish and Game Podcast.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Harvesting Nature's Wild Fishing Game Podcast. You got your host here, Justin Townsend, and today we have a very special guest that I'm looking forward to chatting with. But quickly, because I want to definitely get into some of the good conversation, I will pass you some updates. So kind of in between weeks for me of being in the mountains or on the plains. So this weekend I'm heading up with both Jack and AJ, two of my good friends that you've seen me hunt with before or heard me hunt with before. I think that's how that works. But anyway, you've seen them in pictures and stories and video. But we're headed up to Wyoming here on Sunday to do some antelope hunting, followed on by some cow elk up in the Bighorn Mountains. So pretty excited for that. I've been getting a lot of snow up there. Actually, Ryan and Emily are up there right now, and they are both sending me pictures of a very snowy plains with the lack of antelope. So wishing the best for them as they go through these next 3 or 4 days of antelope hunting and then follow on for myself. But outside of that, I just do want to plug a couple of our podcast initiatives. So as many of you may know, if you listened to the last episode, we just recently moved over to the Waypoint Podcast Network. So we're there now. You can find us on all your standard podcast platforms. In addition to Waypoint has an app, Waypoint TV, as well as their website, I think it's waypointtv.com. Check us out there. Let them know that you listen to us and are avid listeners, and it helps us get in the good graces of the other podcasts in this network. But good to go. And then also on that network is Antler and Fin, which is our audio cookbook series. So that's on whatever podcast platform you're listening to, as well as on Waypoint. But that's just kind of like our recipe. Takes you step by step, ingredient by ingredient, through the various recipes we have on Harvesting Nature, in case you want to listen from an audio sense. Oh, also our Facebook community page. Be sure to check that out, Wild Fish and Game Community. It's over on Facebook. That's a good place to interact with everybody sort of day-to-day, all the major contributors and players in Harvesting Nature there. So if you've got questions about cooking, want to share some of your adventures, or even, you know, share new recipes, some food photos, we always like those. And then I think at the end of this episode, we're going to talk about some book giveaway details. Am I right, Lori?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so we're going to get to that at the end, but that encourages you to listen to the end all the way through. Don't fast forward. That's cheating. And learn the details on that. We're going to be giving away one of Lori's cookbooks, which I'm really looking forward to it coming out because already the pictures I've seen and the descriptions I've read, it sounds really phenomenal. And we're going to talk about it in more detail today so you too can get psyched for the opportunity to purchase one and or receive one. So we'll go for that. But without further ado, I'll go ahead and introduce Lori. So our guest today is dedicated to the cultural foods of Newfoundland and Labrador. She has been featured in National Geographic, The Telegraph, National Post, and many other publications. She is the founder of Cod Sounds, which offers recipes, workshops, and wild food experiences in the Newfoundland and Labrador region. And she will be releasing a new book, as I just said, this year, which is called Food, Culture, Place, Stories, Traditions, and Recipes of Newfoundland. Lori McCarthy, welcome to the Wild Fishing Game Podcast.
Oh, thank you for having me. Nice to be here. Looking forward
to it. Yeah, it's good. So there's a big time difference between you and I.
It is, yeah. You're Pacific, so...
Mountain time.
Mountain. Yep. So we are 7:30 here now at night, and okay. In Newfoundland we have our own time zone, so we're actually an hour and a half outside of Eastern time even.
Which is cool, and I hate to admit it, I'm sorry that I didn't know, believe it or not, I have a geography degree, and that's something that was on my radar. I'm sure there's a geography teacher somewhere scoffing to themselves at that realization.
Right, sometimes we lose skills that we don't need anymore. So first of all, we got to teach you how to say Newfoundland, right? It happens with everyone.
Okay.
You're not unique. So it's not Newfoundland. It's Newfoundland. Newfoundland. All in one word.
Newfoundland. Newfoundland.
No, not Lind. No, Newfoundland.
Land. Newfoundland. Oh, gosh.
There you go. See?
Newfoundland.
Newfoundland.
Got it. All right. You're probably going to have to correct me once or twice more. You know, I'm from the southeast or southern United States, and my accent tends to vary depending. But I appreciate the lesson.
You're in good company. It's an ongoing joke here when people visit. It's like, nope, right away, we got to make sure you say it right.
So I guess for those folks who may or may not know geographically, can you give me a slight description?
Yeah,
on where
sure.
you are.
So we're an island on the most easterly point of land in Canada. We are, you know, next point to land as the crow flies is England.
Okay.
And it's a much bigger island than most people think. I mean, it takes about 12 hours to drive across it.
Oh,
and
wow.
You know, 14 or 15 from, you know, tip to tip diagonally. Yeah, you know, more than 90% of the island is uninhabited, so it makes for some great hunting.
Yeah.
People come from all over the world to hunt, you know, big game here, moose mostly. We have a very interesting several microclimates here. I mean, I guess not unlike the mountains and stuff. But, there's, like, Arctic tundra. There's deep boreal forests. There's... it's a landscape like I've never really been on before, but you know, it goes without saying that I'm pretty partial to it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, you born and raised there?
Absolutely. Yep.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. And what? So, if I was to visit, what would be the major town that I would travel into and then adventure out from?
Yeah. So you likely fly into St. John's, which is, you know, right on the most easterly edge. Lots of people fly into Deer Lake, which is more central or western, really. And, you know, the west coast of Newfoundland is mountains. It's all actually part of the Appalachians out there.
Oh,
and,
cool.
Yeah, completely different landscape from one end to the other. It's, you know, if you come, it's a huge national park out there, Grossmoor National Park, and people travel from everywhere to get out there. And actually, it's one of the few national parks that allow a hunt actually in the park. And you can fly in by chopper, and they'll drop you off deep in the interior. And when you get your moose, they'll they'll actually topper you out. They'll just hook onto it and take it out and drop it right in the back of your truck.
That's awesome. What a delivery service.
Well, it's like delivery like no other, right? And it's because the numbers are enormous, mm-hmm. and they're so destructive on the woods over there, right? So, yeah. But it's a special license that you put in for, and it's you know, sought after.
Yeah, I could imagine. It sounds like an incredible experience. I think a lot of hunters would have that sort of on their bucket list, flying by helicopter, shoot a moose, have the moose delivered back to your vehicle.
Yeah, it's a different hunt to say the least, hey?
Yeah. So how were you introduced into the outdoors? What kind of brought you that journey?
So, I mean, I think like most people here in Newfoundland, you know, we grew up really close to the land, right? Generations here were very close to our generations of family. You know, it's, I mean, most people are very lucky in that all their family, from grandparents and grandmothers and, you know, parents and brothers and sisters, we all, it's like if you're from here, you do whatever's in you to be able to stay here. And so it really lends itself to, you know, learning from the generations past, right? I find that, you know, growing up here, you're so close to the land. I suppose you spend it with your grandparents and your parents, and everything you do is based around picking from the land and harvesting from the land and the sea year round. And so it's a lot of those traditions come from, or, you know, very steeped in being with your family and that being a tradition, you know, whether it's berry picking or fishing and, yeah, and then right into the hunting season. And so very fortunate. And, you know, it's not always the case here, but most of, we have, I mean, our capital city is like 150,000. There's only 500,000 people on the whole island, and pretty big, right? So we're very sparsely, you know, dispersed. Most of the people are in the out along the coastline, of course, for fishing. That's our tradition here. So, or you know, you just grow up in a place where you feel. I mean, I feel very lucky to have grown up next to generations who just lived in the woods and hunted and fished and all that stuff. So, I mean, it was a bit different for me as a girl, as I mentioned to you in our little pre-chat. Yes. You're not always fortunate enough to get to be a part of that. And when you're young, sometimes you don't, you know, I didn't even think of it that I was missing out. I didn't think of it even that it was an opportunity. It was an option for me, you know? And so it's very, you know, steeped in tradition around here still.
Sure. But I was going to ask if that's something that you think has changed over time, or does
absolutely.
It kind of remain the same?
No, it's absolutely changing. And, you know, I think that I was surprised to learn that there was a lot of women out hunting with their husbands and with their family members and their brothers and fathers and stuff. And so it definitely is changing. I mentioned to you earlier, we, you know, when I started hunting, and I'm fairly new to it, I guess it's 5 years now. And I pulled my first moose license, my first moose tags 3 years ago, and hunted, put a lot of miles on my sticks, as I say, out in the woods, and was unsuccessful. But even when I started getting into it and even with like upland birds and stuff, it's really hard to break into it, right? Like, it's like you're so intimidated by this culture of hunting, and, you know, it's like the old guard here, right? It's like the old fellas, right? And, it's hard. And I think I realized that I think I first got into it through, you know, cooking, and my life has been in restaurants. And so I really wanted to start diving into the meat side of it and how can we make the most of this animal in ways that we can still put it on the table today. In a new way, and even if it was kind of breaking tradition from the traditional meals. And so when I first started getting involved, it was that trying to form that relationship with the people who were punching the moose, right down to, you know, where they make those cuts. And then when it went to the, and then was the how do I find a butcher who will actually butcher it like I want it?
Yep.
So, and it's such an enormous animal. It's like our only big it's our biggest game animal here next to caribou. And those are the only two we have big game outside of bear. So that's how I started getting into it. It was like, okay, so we have this enormous animal and it shows up in all the same cuts. And it's like that shameful thing that we hear as, you know, new modern day hunters is that most of the animal will just get ground. And that just became heartbreaking to me, right? Yep. And even more heartbreaking, you'd hear at the end of the year that there's like meat in the freezer that didn't get eaten. And that just broke.
Not a problem at my house. We're scraping the bottom.
Well, luckily it's not a problem in our house anymore either. So, but that's how, you know, that's how I got into it. Yeah. You know, it's a slow process, and finding mentors was a challenge. And, but you know what I really loved is that once I reached out and you put yourself out there, man, there's such good people out there mm-hmm. who just really, they want to see it continue so bad, right? And they're so willing to share their knowledge that, first thing I did was join the Rod and Gun Club here. We have an amazing active, group of participants in our Rod and Gun Club, and those guys just like take you right under their wing. And mm-hmm. you know, I go and do dinners up there, and we would you know, you bring up the guns, you bring up the shells, and you're like, literally, what do I do with this? Like, does this get, like, the first gun I had, I showed up there and there's this guy who's just a great guy. He's like one of this scary, burly guy in the corner who, like, I'm afraid to talk to. And I start talking to him, and I'm like, you know, I've got this gun. And he's like, hold that up now. And I hold it up, and he's like, so that gun don't even fit you. And I was like, oh, shit. So, but, you know, he's like, this is what you need. This is how a gun should fit you. And just, like, amazing, right? From there, we went to start a program we called the Girls with Guns. So mm-hmm. it was brought on from me and my girlfriend, Laura Nesbitt, who's like my hunting partner. We were like, man, you know, we started getting people reaching out. Like, how'd you get into hunting? How do you talk, you know, where do you start around here? And I was like, man, we should just do like a day program and bring everyone together. And it was fantastic. It was great. That's awesome. So nice to see like that intergenerational and passing on a knowledge and mentorship.
And now it's gone full circle from you, from a mentor to mentee, or mentee to mentor, and all the sorts. I think it's a good constant cycle to stay in the mix of.
It is. It's always be learning. Always realize the more you learn, the less you actually know about anything.
Oh, and 100%.
And that's, you know, you can add that to foraging or hunting or fishing, and, you know, just always stay curious, like I say to people about this stuff, and ask questions. And, you know, you can't let that I don't know what I'm doing or I don't know what I'm talking about stop you.
And I think, too, an important thought for folks, and not insinuating that you approach it this way, because I don't believe that's the case, but, like, people that walk into it with sort of that kind of know-it-all thought, or, like, not being willing to take the answers to the questions they ask. Like,
right.
In some instances, a little bit of humble pie works well, and just to be like, I have to ask the question, and no matter the answer, like, I just have to accept that answer until, you know, I learn otherwise. And, like, it could be a point of conversation, but I think you close a lot of doors if you're like, ah, well, you know, I read on the internet that it says this, like, people are going to shut you down.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's at any experience level. I think about, I've got a good friend, his name's Craig, and Craig and I turkey hunted together last year in Central Florida. And it was the first time we'd hunted Osceola turkey, which is the very special species that only resides in Florida. And we were there hunting that, and we were like at lunch at the local diner. And Craig is very outwardly curious and we'll have conversations. So somebody's like, hey, what are you guys hunting? And Craig's like, we're hunting turkeys. And he's like, you know where to find any? And the guy's like, well, actually I do. He's like, go over town, drive across railroad tracks, like turn down this road, drive down, you know, half a mile. The closer you get to the river, the more likely you're to find a turkey.
we had been hunting like 5 miles away on the other side of this like area of woods, and we never would have known the difference because it was a new area to us. And it's just like that little thing of being like, okay, like let's try it. Like the guy was curious. We just engaged him in conversation, and then he ended up coming back over to our table another time and like giving us some other places, and just like it turned into a really good conversation. And I was very thankful. But it is that thing, like I can't pretend to be a know-it-all. I'm not, and I don't want to be, because so many more people know much more than I do, which is great.
Well, it's just that those are the moments that if you let, I find myself anyway, if you just give the space to let those moments happen, people will open up to you about stuff. Whether they're, I remember stopping almost the same and like asking a guy about goose hunting, right? It's like, and like a goose hunt in Newfoundland, it's like no one ever tells you where their geese are. So it's not like so it's not like I see, when I see people in fields, and there's like these fields of corn, and this is mm-hmm. where the geese come. And so we don't have any agriculture here, so mm-hmm. there's no big fields of anything. So good luck trying to find six geese who are hanging out together somewhere.
Oh, wow.
I remember just talking to a guy in town. He's, just chatting about anything. I was like, looking to do a bit of bird hunting. It's kind of new to me. Blah, blah. Sure, geese. Sure, there's a pile of geese up on that pond that I go, every time I go up blueberry picking, there's a pile of geese. And I'm like, okay, that's fantastic. Thank you.
Yeah.
So, awesome. Yeah, it was good. It's fun.
I think it's, I also like to, you talk about people opening up in the community, and it's like, if you don't ask the question, sometimes people just, they don't know that you're seeking the knowledge. And I think that's probably a big encouragement piece to people, is like, just ask. Like,
yeah. And I find with the older generations, like, I feel a little bit like, they get lost in the shuffle a bit. We get so caught up in our modern day hunt that mm-hmm. we kind of forget the generations of knowledge that they have.
Mm-hmm.
And to be honest, I find that they're dying to share it with you. Like, they love the idea that there's another generation coming behind them to pass that on to, right? And so when you ask them, it's almost like they feel almost honored to pass that information on to you, long as you're willing, right? Like, it's
mm-hmm.
it's a delicate conversation to have, like you say, but if you're just honest and that curiosity, like they love to sit down. Like I say, in Newfoundland, there's like the best conversations that happen over a cup of tea, right? And if you get invited in the shed for a cup of tea, then you're in good hands, because then they're looking to have a conversation with you.
Yes.
Could be a beer, could be anything, but if it happens out in the shed, there's like knowledge, the important knowledge being passed on.
I think it's a great point. Great point to learn. Tea or beer.
Yep, whichever. It depends on the hour of the day.
That's awesome. So when we talk about sort of the outdoor foods, is hunting and fishing and foraging, we'll put them all into the wild foods. Like, which do you find yourself doing most, and which is your favorite?
I say I probably forage more than anything.
Mm-hmm.
Foraging here is something that we grew up with, picking from the land. But it was mostly berries at the time, like when I grew up. Yeah, berries and dandelion was about the stretch of it for us.
Okay.
So we have that, very much that tradition of fall picking. And Newfoundland's a place where nothing grows for 8-9 months of the year. So it's interesting that the mindset today is still that was sort of steeped into mom's generation, which was pick as much as you can now because you're not going to get this thing for another year.
Oh, wow. So, yeah.
So like even something like fruit, like when mom grew up, like mom is only 73 or something. She's more spry than me. She's like goat in the woods, I tell her, right? But like mom can actually remember a time when she says, and she's fascinated, she comes to my house and there's like all this fruit. Like mom says, Lori, she said, when we grew up, there was no fruit. Like, the only time you seen fruit was when the berries came from the ground. So we knew, like, you can't, like, for us today, it's so hard to even wrap our heads around that. You know, when we go to the grocery store, we go wherever, and there's all, you know, fruit from everywhere, right? But Mom says, these things were so special to us as children because it was the only time of year you seen fruit. She said, so when the strawberries came in June, she said, and then the baked apples came, and then the blueberries came. She says, as children, she said, we just spent all our time out in the woods picking, right? Because she said, well, we spent most of our time eating, she would say, as children, right? But you'd go, right? But the tradition of going berry picking was often women's tradition. And the women and the mothers and the sisters and all the aunts and the children would go off in the woods for a day. Now here they call it like going off for a boil up or a mug up, right? And you go off in the woods for a day. But the berries were about subsistence eating then, right? In Mom's time. And it was so important, but you know, it's only years later that you really realize the importance of it. The importance for them was about the berries for sure, but now the importance, you know, sits in my heart with the time that I spent with Mom and my aunts and Nan. And it was really a time when you just learned about that passed on knowledge, right? And whether it was actually about picking berries or it was about, I don't know, whatever, you know, it was just that time that such attention was paid to food too, you know, that's what I remember about it, you know, and picking stuff from the land was very common. You know, fishing was men's work in terms of out on the water. And in Mom's and Nan's time, fishing was women's work happened when it came to shore. And so, it's interesting throughout the generations how much of that work has kind of changed. But it's here I always, you know, Marcia, who wrote the cookbook with me, Marcia will say, you know, she's got all these beautiful old photographs, and you see the men out salmon fishing, and they're, you know, they're dressed like we are today, right? But now, right, Pods goes out salmon fishing now, and sure, they got $4,000 worth of gear on. You can't fish anymore without $800 waders and $400 boots. But it's I always find it interesting that subsistence eating and the new fisherman or the new, you know, salmon fisher. It's interesting juxtaposition.
I think we see it too in like the hunting world. I was thinking the other day, or is it just people like going out? We had an episode on backpacking food, and we were talking about like kind of the evolution of taking food out with you. And people are like, you know, very common like trail mix and beef jerky, or just like the basics, or going out with, you know, just a snack and like hunting all day. But you think about the clothing, as you mentioned, is just like boots and pants and wool shirts, or like, you know, whatever, super super basic, no camouflage, like nothing. And now, you know, I'm guilty of it myself, you know, I wear camouflage, and it's just like it's turned into a performance and a social statement and all these other things that it's kind of like, where do you draw the line at? Where is our culture evolved, you know, in the outdoor world to kind of shape it? And does it lean towards like, this is an accepted norm for everyone, or are we just interested in it, or is it a necessity? Like,
I don't know either. But I mean, I'm sure if we gave my grandfather all the gear that we had on to be as comfortable as we are in the woods right now, like, he would have absolutely taken it.
Oh yeah, 100%. No one's gonna. I remember my grandfather telling me stories of like, he'd be sitting on the side of a pond bank and watching a deer, but the deer got startled because he was sitting there shivering so much because he was cold. And like in today's time, I'm like, Elias, you know, I got 6 layers on, like, I'm good. I'm windproof.
Right. You got your merino wool and your, yep. Right. Yeah. It's interesting. Hey. Yeah. But yeah. I mean, it was, you know, my grandfather would always say, you know, it was, Lori, you know, it was a time when you may do with what you had. Mm-hmm. Right. And so, yeah. And you know, and the hunt was not a luxury hunt. Like, I think, you know, a lot of what we do today is almost, it feels sometimes like a luxury, hey? You know?
Yeah.
Whereas here for, you know, the generations before me, it was definitely a subsistence hunt. I mean, not that we really, we don't really trophy hunt here as a culture, mm-hmm. right? And, you know, we truly, the hunt is about subsistence eating, in that it's really about, you know, the big game, especially, is really the moose, especially. I would say almost exclusively the moose. The moose hunt is about filling your freezer for the winter,
yep.
right? I mean, the big panic comes on when the hunt starts to come, and it's like, do I have enough freezers right now?
Yes, it's a good, like, problem to have.
I know. Like, last week we were, when we got Dad's moose, and I was like, oh man, I need another freezer. And you can forget getting a freezer in Newfoundland in the fall of the year, because, like, they just get bought up, and, like, there's only so many to go around.
I could imagine too, and I think there's some issues freezers worldwide too. At least in the States, I know we're having problems with appliances and things. And
same,
it's just
here.
The other day they said tires. I said, great.
It's always something. It's always something. It's a new world.
That's it.
Yeah.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
I guess that answers my question. Corey, this is one of Corey's favorite questions to ask, and I love it. He's just like, what's in your freezer now? But I think we answered it. Moose.
Yeah, well, it's always full of fur and feathers, actually.
Yep.
And, you know, we could go all around the place on how you, the best way to keep game birds and meat and stuff. But traditionally here, you know, the upland birds, the saltwater ducks, all that stuff was frozen with the feathers on. It seemed to be the best way to do it, and so oftentimes I just do it like that. Same with the rabbits, you know. I'll just leave them fur on. It's like it's better protection than anything.
Really?
Yeah, although I found it, yeah, we do. And I know people find it totally weird. I'm like, no, I just freeze the whole thing, gut in, fur on.
Gut in as well?
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure there's better ways to do it maybe, but I don't know. We always did it like that. The meat is wonderful. The fur in the freezer is the best protection ever. And I find for rabbit, the bones are so splintery that what we have is snowshoe hair. Actually, hair.
I was about to say, is it hair? Is hair more like rabbit? So
yeah. So it's real dark, like almost black meat. And we have Arctic hair and snowshoe hair, mostly snowshoe hair. And you can't vacuum pack that stuff, right? It just goes through all the bags. I'm like, okay, someone has got to come up with a bag that's like rabbit bone proof. What are we doing?
That's a business idea.
Right? But yeah, so the best way to do it, that's how I do it anyway, and lots of people do it like that. And you just take them out as you need them and thaw them out and skin them, gut them, you know?
Gut them. Huh.
Same with the birds. Like, lots of times I've been given birds as gifts. They'll come home and there's a particular fellow here lives not far from me, and he'll call Larry Han. Larry will call and say, Lori, where are you to? It's like, old Larry, boy, I'm out darting around, like, you know. Yeah, I just came by, I hung a few turs on the door, right? He's not kidding, like, I'll come home and there's turs hanging on the door. And so turs are one of those birds, it's like this coveted bird in Newfoundland. We're actually... I don't know, but we're the only place that's actually legal to hunt them in all of Canada.
Oh, wow. I'm going to have to look them up.
Yeah, so it's the M-U-R-R-E, I believe. That's how it's spelled. And so we call them turs here. They're a saltwater bird. Much like the puffin, like in you know, in Iceland and the Faroe Islands, they still eat the puffin up there. And we don't eat it here. It's become this pretty tourism icon here, so we don't get to eat them anymore, unfortunately. But the tur is a special saltwater bird for sure to us, and special I mean just like dear to our hearts in terms of that being close to tradition and a very cultural food for sure. I freeze the turds with the feathers on, got in.
Yeah, I mean, I'm starting to see exactly what you're saying there. Yeah, the feathers and fur, I mean, that's their natural purpose is to keep the cold out. So
yeah, it works great.
I'm going to have to give that a try. But I was just looking, it looks like the New York Times, they did an article back in 2016 on tur hunting.
Yes, I think I've brought that up. I think there's a couple of pictures there of the turs up in the top of the boat, the bow of the boat, yeah.
Very, oh, there they are.
Very fishy birds, people would say. Oh, you know, the young people today won't eat them, right? They're like, oh, they're so fishy. But, yeah, they're fishy. They eat fish.
Yeah. It's part of it. It tastes like what it's supposed to taste like.
Exactly. And it was funny, in the book, you know, Marcia talks about how she was determined to find something to do with the tur so it didn't kind of taste like tur. And she ended up marinating it in a local distillery, aquavit.
Okay.
Yeah, and then we just seared it, like barely seared it and served it sort of medium rare, which would be like nobody here would eat that. I mean, it'd be unheard of. My father would come over and be like, "What did you do as a bird?" And he'd be disgusted.
What's the way people would normally eat it?
So they would be, you know, traditionally they'd be just skinned or not skinned. If you pluck the tur, the pluck of tur is an art in itself. I was actually able to go down with Larry, who I mentioned earlier, into his shed one day, and I was determined to learn how to pluck turs. I was like, this is going to be one of these lost art things. Anyway, so to pluck it, you know, you leave all the skin on it, and all the fat is in the skin, and then all that strong flavor, of course. People would talk about meat, right, and game birds and stuff, especially seabirds. And, there are people who will say that, oh, my God, you know, the husband or cooking turs, I won't even go in the house, right? But so they would be roasted, right? Roasted, skin on, stuffed with a traditional stuffing of savory and breadcrumbs and onions.
Okay.
And then a gravy would be made on them, and they would be cooked several hours in the oven. And the only thing that saved them was the amount of gravy that you put on them. Right to hear, I was actually read into a woman tonight. Yeah, I read into a woman tonight who she said to me, she's like, "My God, I'd love a few turs now, knee deep in gravy." I was like, "Oh my God."
That's awesome.
So that's traditionally how most things were cooked here, right? Like long, slow roasted. Even went moose and stuff like that, like, which is why I was so determined to kind of prove to people that it can be, these meats can be, and you know, just enjoy today like you can enjoy any piece of any kind of meat that you have, right? It doesn't, just because we always ate it like that, it doesn't mean that we have to continue to do it, right? And for me, I think if we want to keep these, you know, for me it's important that we keep these meats and this sort of way of life present on our table. And in order to do that, we are going to have to change how we prepare it. And like I tell people, that's okay, right? It's because Dad won't come and eat it that way. That's all right. I'll cook a roast for him 18 hours in the oven, and he'll come and be really happy with it. And then I'll have the backstraps done like medium rare with, you know, some sort of cranberry something wild I picked, and it'll be brown butter, and my mom will think it's fantastic.
That's awesome. A good spread, but it definitely shows the changes in the palate and the changes in the food culture over time.
Yeah, and I think it's okay to change, right? Like, I think we got to change, but if we don't eat it, if we stop eating it, that's my fear, is that we won't pay attention when, you know, I mean, for you guys, it's like I often hear about down in the States about, you know, hunting land, right? And the land that you get to hunt on. And we won't pay attention when changes get made with that. We won't pay attention to the quotas and when the hunts get cut back. Or if it's not present on our plate and it's not part of our diet, my fear is that we will stop paying attention to it. And I think overall that's a lot of my driving force, is that we need to keep putting it on the table.
I agree, and I think especially we've seen a large emergence of sort of, people call it like the field to fork or field to table movements or, you know, whatever it is. And that's, the food has been the connection point for bringing younger generations back out into the wild to hunt, to fish, to forage, to, you know, and each one as its own has seemed like a gateway to the other. And I think that's incredible because we do have an abundance of it. It's just like, do people care enough to protect it, as you said, or to pay attention? And yep, yeah, when you start putting important things on forks and spoons and cutting them with silverware, and people pay attention.
I agree for sure. Like, when I grew up, most of the anything outside of berries and, say, almost dandelion exclusively was, we were always told that that was poison, right? Mm-hmm. And parents and mothers and grandmothers told their kids that, don't eat that, that's poison. That's poison, don't eat that, right? That was always what we were told. Because telling us that everything was poison kept us from eating stuff we shouldn't have been eating, right?
Oh, yeah.
Because they didn't know, right? They didn't know what this stuff was and what was edible. And so, but I think, you know, and that being the message I know here is created a really big fear around eating stuff from the land, which is kind of, you know, it's disappointing in that we have this big fear of the food that comes, that's like the ground that we walk on, mm-hmm. right? And like, I'll take my mom to the beach now, and I'll like, Mom, we can go to the beach with not only frying pan and butter, basically, of course, butter for everything, but and like gather wood, light a fire, pick seaweed to steam mussels, pick mussels, and pick mm-hmm. enough greens on the beach to make a salad. And we can have mussels and, you know, steamed in seaweed with enough greens to make a salad. And, that'll, like, blow my mom's mind. And she's one of those people who will love the idea because they never knew that that stuff was available to them, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, for the next generation of kids, like, of coming behind me and well, even my generation, like, this is a time when I feel that food is really changing here, in that we're becoming so aware of the food beneath our feet. It's happening everywhere, which is amazing, right? I think it's fantastic. So my children will be the first generation of children who will actually grow up picking mushrooms, and it will be a part of their culture. Because hundreds of kids now are out picking mushrooms with their parents, no and question. That didn't happen in my time because no one knew what the mushrooms were.
Yeah,
right. And like my grandfather always says, 100 years from now, Lori, right? This is his thing. 100 years from now, and we lost him during COVID, so there's always these you know, pop-isms coming back, right? And the pop would say, you know, 100 years from now, he said, sure, that's what you'll be eating, right? Or that's how it will be, right? And so that's how it will be, is that these kids today will now get to grow up learning so much more about what the food that comes from the land in a different way. And isn't that what it's all about? That's, you know?
It's such an awesome thought and a realization, even like a goal. Like,
yeah, I love it.
Oh, man, me too.
Yeah, so you know excited. You have to come here, right?
I want to come. I've never visited. I'm trying to think. The furthest north I've been is in Maine, the very southern part of Maine in the U.S.
And yeah, they get Daniel Vitalis. I don't know if you know him. We had him up a couple of years ago. Daniel came. He's from Maine. Big wild food guy and hunter, and yeah, I mean, he came up and it was fantastic to introduce people to this place for sure. It's a very different landscape than most people get a chance to like to live on.
As we've been discussing, and you even after you kind of described the geography to me, I'm just like trying to picture everything in my head and like put myself in the scenarios of like conversations or, you know, learning and out on adventures and foraging and fishing, and I'm just like, wow, it sounds like an incredible place.
It is. So. It's a beautiful place to discover, you know, food from the land, I gotta say. And you know, I really only took it on as my lifestyle and my work, mm-hmm. you know, in the past 10 years, really. I mean, I guess it's been 10 years that it's been very intentional and, you know, and a very intentional purpose and way of life, right, where I don't have to buy any meat from the supermarket, you know. I'm mm-hmm. absolutely fortunate. And it's funny, like you say, like it almost feels like today is, you know, it almost feels like this privilege sometimes that to get to eat like this, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you still get to eat like this living here. Like you can if you want to.
Yeah.
But you can't, I mean, the stuff that I forage, you can't buy it anywhere, right? The cured meats that I make from the moose, you can't buy it. You know, even the charcuterie I make from the locally raised pork. Like, you can't buy it. There's nowhere here. You can't buy local charcuterie here. Like, I remember for years going to New York or going to Montreal and going to the big markets and, like, seeing what people were doing with meat and, like, taking empty suitcases home of cured meat. And then there was that moment where it's like, man, what could I do with what's here, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
it's a turning point. Becomes easy, not easier because you have to learn technique and all this other stuff, but it becomes more available, and then it becomes a part of thoughts.
Yeah, it becomes available, and this amazing, you know, journey that you get to take if it interests you enough to take it, I suppose, you know.
Yeah.
And so, and it did for me, and it's absolutely changed my life, you know. I guess it's all what brings purpose and meaning to your life now, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I was just thinking about that and like in thinking about purpose, it's like life's kind of a series of small journeys. Maybe not traveling per se, but just like journeys, like journey into whatever, whatever makes you happy, like whatever you want to learn. Like, I think that I never thought about it before, but that really defines like purpose in life of like all these mini journeys.
I just all the time, it's like just find something that sets you on fire, right?
Yeah.
Right, and like at the moment, for me. Well, at the moment, it's koji. I don't know if you know koji. It's this, like, ancient Japanese mole that I'm in love with now.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm growing
I've heard of it.
Holy, it's freaked. It's like, I just had a guy come here from, I hosted a guy from Boston who just wrote a book on koji, and he just spent a week here. And I've, like, had him out, and we foraged land. We hunted unsuccessfully. But and, you know, he brought koji to Newfoundland. And now I invited a bunch of chefs over who will actually do something with this knowledge, right? And they will change food in Newfoundland. And that's the stuff that just, like, blows your mind. Like, to
me,
that's just, yeah, like, when I discovered that I could actually make charcuterie out of the meat that came from here, and I can apply a technique that no one's ever applied to the meat from here, and now we butchered a lamb the other night, and it's like, I'm going to be able to apply a technique that I just learned to an animal in Newfoundland. We call them the saltwater lambs because they put them out on these islands off the coast. It might sound ridiculous. But anyway, so at the spring of the year, all the lambs go out to these islands, and there's no predators out there. And they live out on the islands all summer. And the fall, they come back by boat. In like small fishing boats, and they carry the lambs back and forth, and they're saltwater lambs. They live off the land out there. They taste amazing. And then you butcher a lamb, and now we're able to apply something new. And that's when food and culture changes. Like,
yep,
that will be a food that will be eaten that will never have been made here before. And like, I don't know, how could that not excite you? It's like, now we're making moose brisola. Like,
uh-huh.
No one's ever made moose brisola here.
No.
That just sets me on fire. I don't know. it's whatever your thing is, right? But
it's just so cool. Yeah, I'm excited. Oh, man. You're speaking my language.
Right? That's what we should be doing. Just think about the people you can bring together, the change you can make that make impact. Like,
mm-hmm.
And if your jam is like your food and your culture and the people and the place you are, like, man, just get into it.
Right?
Right?
I just started a new journey myself. And I'm not a baker, right? By no means am I a baker. But I've decided that this year I'm going to learn to be a baker. So I've started down the sourdough bread journey. Yeah.
Nice.
I'm like 4 loaves in now. It's been about a month and a half of, not even a month, I would say 3 weeks, because I was out hunting and I started my starter and like all these other things. I got my first like baker's burn the other day.
Nice.
And I was like,
nice.
Cool. Like I'm legit now. No, but it's fun. I picked up a book. It's called New World Fermented Breads, I think it is.
Ooh.
But the gentleman who wrote it is based, I believe, out of Miami. And okay. So he puts a lot of, like, Latin American spins, like,
cool.
New World kind of – he's got, like, coconut bread in there that's got, like, coconut flour and coconut shred and just, like, all these things. But it's just like, oh, man, what a cool concept. So I've told my wife that it's my goal that I'm going to cook through all the bread in this book.
Oh, what a benefit to her. She just gets to reap the rewards.
Oh, yeah.
That's fantastic.
She's great. We've been eating, I've been baking at least once a week. So, like, I'll do a couple loaves and it'll last us the week. And it's just, like, it's fun. My daughter's looking forward to it. And so that gets me excited. So
yeah. And then, you know, all this, it's all, like, just get excited about anything and just take it on, right? It's like hunting and, I mean, like I said, hunting for me was is something that's kind of new, but to be able to have that product right from the field and to be able to explore it and cure it and I don't know, taste it and do stuff with it that's never been done before. I mean,
it's pretty awesome. So let's segue into that. Let's talk a little bit about your book, because there's a lot in there. It's more than just a cookbook. Am I right?
Yeah, it's definitely more than just a cookbook, and I think that was always the intent, for it to be more than a cookbook. I was approached for a couple of years by a couple of publishers to write a book. I was, you know, face and eyes into my business at the time, and primarily the business was a tourism business, and people came and they traveled here, and this place became a bit of a culinary hotbed. And so I would take people out foraging. We'd spend 4 or 5 hours together. I'd light a fire. We'd cook 5 or 6 courses over open fire, all food of here and stuff that we picked along the way. And it was, amazing. It was wonderful. And then of course COVID hit and I shut my business down. The nature of cooking out in the bush would, you know, anyway. Sanitary and all those things that COVID just destroyed.
Oh, man.
So I shut the business down, and actually one of the publishers called me and said, "Don't suppose you want to write that book now?" I was like,
"You're like, actually."
Well, right. And so I thought to myself, like, I don't have that attention to detail. These are, you know, things that you realize about yourself as you get a bit older. And I was like, I really want this book to have beautiful photographs, and I'm going to need someone to help me make this happen.
Mm-hmm.
Just knowing myself all too well, Marcia ended up at one of my courses. Actually, it was like a pork butchery course, and quickly did I realize, like, I'm not sure why you're here, because I think you can butcher this pig better than I can. And it was clear that we were at the same kind of crazy that, you know, was just super exciting to both of us. We could definitely, like, find our way around the kitchen and pickle and bottle meat and butcher animals and make charcuterie and slum anyway. So we just hit it off. We became great friends. And I remember saying to her this day, like, I suppose you want to, like, write a book. And she's like, yeah, okay. And I was like, really? And she's like, yeah. So that's how it started. And for years, when I started traveling around the island for work, I started talking to people and collecting their stories. And so I would then use it as an excuse to get into people's homes and sit with them and have a cup of tea or have a beer in the shed and ask them about, you know, growing up and what. So it might sound weird, I guess, but much of the island is still uninhabited, like I mentioned.
Yeah.
And much of it is still only accessible by boat. There are communities all around the island that there's still no roads to. And it's, you know, you can think of it like Italy in that the food is so regional here and very different from, you know, from community to community. Because when it came, it kind of stayed because there was no... There was no way to get from community to community. So however it was made like that. And, you know, what now takes a half an hour to drive took 2 hours by ferry. So no one ever went from here to there. So the food and the traditions of how the food was prepared for the winter, and like I said, you know, in a place where nothing grows for 8 or 9 months of the year, those preservation techniques stayed in those places. And so... You know where where smelt comes in is there's very small pockets of places where smelt come in. There's very small places where eels come in, and nobody else gets freshwater eels. Or the seal hunt happens in very particular places. And so the more I went out and the more I traveled these places, the more I was just like starving to hear the stories of how food in this place was made and preserved. And it was like, I had to start collecting these stories. Like I just started to create this fear that they were going to be lost. And if, and nobody was writing this down. I was like, how can no one understand the gravity of these preservation techniques and, and how important they are to how we actually, why we're still here. Right. So, I started collecting stories, whether it was by recording or by I had people write them down, or I would sit and make notes. And you know, Marcia's the same. Like she's been collecting stories from her family forever. And so a lot of this book is around the tradition. It's around the people that we met, that we've met over the years. It's around our own families and the traditions. Generations past and how food came to be and why the traditions were so important, right? And the gravity of the, you know, when the capelin rolled, right? So the capelin are the small, smelt like fish. They roll on our beaches here in June. They were a food source, but almost even more important, they were what, how farmers and actually like fertilized the fields. And how they actually made soil in Newfoundland. So, there's no, I mean, soil in Newfoundland is like, almost don't exist. Like there are places, there's, they call us the rock, right? So they don't call us the rock for nothing, right? There's very little agriculture happens here. There's the Cotteroy Valley on the west coast of Newfoundland where there's some, you know, agriculture that can happen. But overall, where our lands are very barren, very boreal forest, very Arctic tundra. So soil was made with kelp and seaweed from the sea and fish. And so
Composting, basically.
Yeah, right. So they just actually made soil, right? Kelp and capelin and kelp and capelin and that. And so... For something that today, so the capelin come in to spawn on the sandy beaches, and when they do, that like hundreds of pounds of capelin will wash ashore and dry up and die, right, when the tide goes out. And so that's always collected by the local people, right? The capelin and the kelp that roll in, it's all collected and taken back to even their own gardens in their backyard. So the idea of trying to explain to people and how important that was to growing food is what we shared, right? The idea, the tradition of how important it is today that we all still bring our children to the beach so that we can collect the capelin and the old guy is there still with the old traditional cast net, you know, throwing the cast net out with all the little lead weight balls on the bottom, and how he throws that net and how he'll bring it in. He don't want the capelin. He brings it in and opens that net, and all the cape, you know, the 4 or 5 pounds of capelin flip-flop on the beach, and all the little kids come over with their buckets and pick them up. Like, That's what we did as kids, right? That's what Marcia talks about that she did with her children. Like, that's how you continue to pass that stuff on, right? It's through doing. Mm-hmm. It's through letting them see and being involved in things like that. Same with the hunt, right? And so, yeah, so the book is full of those kind of stories. And you know, my mom's tea buns and my great-grandmother's gingerbread cake. And then there's the stuff that Marcia and I are doing with moose, and there's moose brazola, and there's, like, rabbit liver pate. So it's new discoveries. It's old. I don't know.
It sounds to me like very much a culinary love note, as you will.
Culinary love notes. I love it. Well said.
I love it. Yeah. Just the whole thing. It sounds incredible.
We'll get a copy out to you, and we'll get a copy out to our listeners.
Yeah. Let's. Can we talk through a couple of the recipes? So I'm really curious about the moose recipes.
Mm.
Or your own moose recipes, even if they didn't make it into the book. Very curious.
Yeah, I think our favorite discovery, well, my favorite discovery was probably the salt moose. And So in here, the salt beef was, and that's a brined beef, right, in a liquid brine, was how meat was preserved here. And so every Sunday we have what's called Jig's Dinner. And so the Jig's Dinner is almost what you think of the French pot au feu, which is there's a piece of salted meat and soaked overnight, and the next day it's put into this pot and it's cooked for 3 or 4 hours, and then you start to layer all the vegetables in, the cabbage, all the root vegetables, the turnip, the carrots, the potatoes, and that's all cooked, and then there's a gravy made on a piece of fresh meat. But before there was the fresh meat, there was wild game, and then before there was wild game, there was even just the salted meat.
Yep.
And so the idea, like I mentioned earlier, that there was meat that was, you know, cuts of meat that were left in the freezer that nobody did anything with. You know, in the beginning, I started collecting all this meat where people were like, the hunt is up again. It's moose hunting season. I still have meat. I was like, just give me your meat. I'll make you salt meat, and then I'll just give it back to you. And so we started making, like, in England, they call it like corned beef, right? But here it's salt meat, and so it's made with beef traditionally, but now I make it with moose. And so now there's like moose pastrami sandwiches being made, moose tongue pastrami sandwiches, and amazing. I love it.
Corey would love that. He's got some solid goose pastrami recipes.
See?
And he like brines, he'll brine them. It takes him 3 days usually to make it. He'll brine them, or maybe longer. Brines them, and then he smokes them, and seasons them 3 or 4 different ways, and then slices them for pastrami sandwiches, and just like, stuff.
I haven't had enough goose in my life to play with, but I would sort of depend on other people to bring me goose. Have I not had a successful goose hunt yet?
I'm hoping to get more into goose this year. We'll see, because I was down in Florida, and you don't get too many geese down that way.
Snow geese seem to be the big thing here in the Maritime provinces and across Canada. It seems like we don't get snow. We mostly just have the Canada goose here.
That's pretty common, I think, what I've seen here mostly. But I know they have they do have a snow goose. And a lot of the middle states in the U.S., they're having a lot of problems with the snow goose. So there's, like, extra seasons tacked on and unlimited bag limits and things like that.
Oh, my gosh. I should go do that then.
It sounds phenomenal.
Sounds like I need a goose hunt in my life.
Exactly.
A little goose hunt vacation.
So, well, I guess let's talk a little bit about this book giveaway.
Yeah. How do we
do
that?
I had an idea, and my idea is that what I think people should do is they should screenshot the podcast that they're listening to right now, take a screenshot, and you can share it on Instagram and Facebook, or Instagram or Facebook, and you tag Harvesting Nature and you tag Cod Sounds when you do it.
Awesome. Can we tag Food Culture Place too?
Yep, let's do that.
Like it.
I'll put that in the show notes. Food Culture Place. Tag them as well. So three tags.
Yeah.
So take a screenshot. It can just be like you're on Apple Podcasts with the episode title and whatever minute you're at, which would probably be this minute. But take a screenshot and then share that on your Instagram or your Facebook. Tag Harvesting Nature, tag Cod Sounds, and tag
Food Culture Place.
Food Culture Place. And then what we'll do is we'll compile all those results, and then we'll randomly select a winner on November 17th. That's a Wednesday when we typically release podcasts. So whatever episode releases on November 17th, listen to that episode, and I'll announce it in the first part of that show.
Wicked.
It sounds awesome.
Perfect. So the books are now available on Indigo and Amazon. And yeah, they are ready for order.
The cover, I have it pulled up on Amazon right now. The cover looks phenomenal. Like, what is that dish? What is the dish on the front?
So this was Marsha's creation. The piece behind this is actually a painting that I had from a dear friend of mine in Montreal. His name is Scott McLeod, and I had actually just pulled the painting off the wall because I was moving some stuff around.
Mm-hmm.
And then the plate is from a local potter, Alexis Templeton, who I have to mention, of course. And that's smoked salmon. So as Marcia and I have drove across the island, there is a little corner store. Okay, so corner stores are the heart of Newfoundland. And there is a little corner store where you can go, and this guy from the community makes smoked salmon.
Ooh.
And so we had stopped on our trip across the island and picked up some smoked salmon. And then everything else there, and the baked apple is that's on the fork. That's like the berry. My mother says is like picking hen's teeth. As we all know, hen's teeth are very rare. But picking baked apples in Newfoundland is like walk 6 feet, pick one. Walk another 6 feet, pick another one.
Oh, wow.
So they're pickled. And Marcia picked all those beautiful weeds from the land. There's wintercress and there's dandelions and watercress and sorrel, and I'm just looking at it and going,
oh, it looks so good.
And there's larch and juniper the painting was laid on top of the deep freeze actually, and she made the plate and laid it on the painting, and it was like, oh my gosh. So we had done like maybe six specific photo shoots for this cover, and none of them between the publisher and the distributors were particularly happy with.
isn't it funny how that always works out?
I know, and this was just like that happenstance photo that just came, and we were like, man, that's pretty nice. And everyone kind of liked it. And then down in the corner, there's like dandelion seeds that were just blown off so. It's become pretty special.
Yeah, it should be. Yeah. You should get it printed and frame it.
Yes. Yeah, that's not a bad idea, actually.
Yeah.
I have the plate now. It sits in my dining room on a little plate stand. And I asked the potter if I could keep it because it was a bunch of her sort of off firings from the kiln. Mm-hmm. And I emailed her the cover. I was like, so the cover's been chosen and it's your plate, and it's kind of important to me now. I'm wondering if I could buy it from you. And she says, let's just say you could keep it. So
awesome.
It was very nice. She's a part of my Rotary group, actually. So lovely person and a wonderful potter.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a nice piece.
Thank you.
For sure.
I'm very happy with the cover.
Well, so now that everyone's gone out and purchased your book, what's the best way they can connect with you on social media?
So Marcia is at Food of Generations.
Okay.
And she is the photographer for the book, and has added at least half the recipes and stories from the west coast of Newfoundland, which sort of tells the story of east to west. I'm at Food Culture Place on Instagram, and on Facebook, and Todd Sounds and Laurie McCarthy at Todd Sounds, and on Facebook too. So mostly Instagram. Instagram is where you can find me, and there's the website Todd Sounds and LaurieMcCarthy.ca.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, this is sort of the part of the show where we give sort of any last thoughts, misfires, alibis, anything you want to leave the listeners or myself with, or ask or request or anything. Anything's up in the air.
No.
So.
I think this is the on the spot sort of fired at me, but it's all right. I would say that what I've taken. You know, this book has been a journey. This embracing this sort of lifestyle has been a new journey for me. It's absolutely changed my life. It's changed the people that I've brought into my life and met people that have absolutely changed my life. It's brought an enormous amount of just depth and understanding to who I am and who the people are that are from here. It's created deep meaning in my life. And so I think for me, I would encourage people to do the same. You know, go sit with your grandparents, go sit with the generation before you, sit with the generation that you brought into the world, or those of you who are around you, and share with them what food is to you. Share with them what your culture is to you, because, man, does it come back tenfold. Yeah.
That's awesome. Well, I appreciate you coming on and chatting with us. I am very much looking forward to reading and cooking my way through your book. I'm excited that we had the opportunity, so thank you for giving us the opportunity to give away a book to a listener. I think that's really awesome as well, and I look forward to hopefully coming for a visit sometime soon.
Yes, absolutely.
So, all right. Well, for everyone else out there, all these show notes will be online, so whatever podcast platform you listen to, you can scroll down, you'll see those, with all the links to the things we talked about, including the links to connect with Lori, and to get the book, to see some of the recipes, and visit Cod Sounds website, and take in all the good things that are going on there. For everyone else, once you're done there, head over to Harvest of Nature on whatever social media platform. Make sure you're following us, because we've got some cool things too. And then whatever podcast platform you're listening to, please punch that 5-star button. Tell us what we're doing wrong, or, tell us what we're doing right. We love it either way. And thanks, everybody. Have a good night.